Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. In the previous episode of Preconceived, we spoke with Dr. Jay Olshansky regarding the science of life extension. We reviewed some of the biological mechanisms of aging and how research is looking into how such mechanisms can be exploited in order to halt the aging process. And while research into life extension is certainly well on its way, it's also clear there's still quite a long way to go. Dr. Olshansky felt that any estimates of a significantly increased life expectancy are false at this point in time, without any substantiated data to suggest we're headed there. But even if life extension treatments don't become available during our lifetime, some argue that the time is now to discuss the ethics of such interventions, as such treatments are being explored. So let's suspend our belief for the next little bit. Let's pretend that life extension research was farther along than it actually is. Let's suppose that all you needed to do was take a pill once a year on your birthday, and it would stop you from aging. You could stop this pill anytime, but as long as you took it every year, you would biologically remain the same age as you are today, unless tragedy struck in the form of an accident, a violent encounter, or a severe infection. You would live indefinitely, perhaps up to 1,000 years old. Would you take such a pill if it were available? I am joined today by John Davis. John is a professor of philosophy at California State University, Fullerton. He specializes in bioethics, applied ethics in general, metaethics and related issues, philosophy of life, and ethical theory. He's the author of New Methuselahs, The Ethics of Life Extension, published by MIT Press in 2018. And he's been interviewed about life extension ethics for the French TV network M6, the Financial Times of London, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, among others. John, thanks so much for joining me. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Zale.
Thank you so much for joining me. I mentioned your book, New Methuselahs, The Ethics of Life Extension. I read it. Incredibly fascinating read. It's just incredible stuff, huh?
Well, thank you. I had a great topic to work with. It made it a lot easier.
You had an incredible topic to work with, but the way you tackle it is very methodical. And you kind of split the book into a few different sections. One, would you want to take this pill if you could? Mm-hmm. And then the second part of your book really addresses, well, let's say people did want to take this. How would we have a society that functions with this? And we'll get into a little bit of everything in this conversation.
Sure.
When I spoke with Jay Olshansky on the last episode, and you reference him in your book, he still felt that we were quite far away from developing life extension, this idea that we would be biologically able to halt the aging process so that if I were to start taking it right now at age 34, that I wouldn't really age and I could live for many, many years. He felt, and I think he said in the past, that anything above 130 years is really, really, really kind of more than unlikely at this point. Yet you talk about what if the possibility if we were to live potentially radical life extension, people living to 1,000 years old. So what prompted you to write this book and to explore this topic?
Right. I've been interested in the topic since I was a teenager. And, you know, I've kind of played around with it for many, many years. I think one reason I wrote the book was simply that I didn't see a book like it out there, and I wanted there to be one. As for why I use the radical life extension scenario, there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is that scenario brings out some of the philosophical issues in a more obvious way. than, say, a moderate life extension, where people live 120, 150 or something like that. But most of what I say about the radical life extension transfers over to the moderate life extension as well, but to a lesser degree. Some of the issues don't, but many of them do. As for how plausible that is, I actually have a section in my book about reasons why life extension might be harder than we think. And I'm not one of those who predicts we're going to see it in the next 20 years or something, and I'm not expecting to have it for myself. I would expect that if it's possible to have life extension, even moderate, we'll have it within the next several decades if it can be done. And it looks like it probably can. And I guess as for radical life extension, I wouldn't argue with Jay Olshansky about that, but I think that if you can slow something down, you should be able to slow it to a halt, right? I mean, what it takes to halt aging isn't in principle very different from what it takes to slow it down. In fact, it may be that aging is like sort of, I don't know, dusting the stairs every day, right? You have to go back and sort of reverse the aging a little bit each day. And if that's the way it works, you might just keep on going until you restored yourself to a fairly youth-like condition.
And for those who didn't listen to the episode with Jay, when you're talking about radical life extension, just because it's important for the definitions here, what you're talking about is, and correct me if I'm wrong, this idea that, which is being explored, that biologically we could kind of stop the aging process. So if you took it at age 50, you'd stop aging and you'd be 50 for the rest of your life. And the radical element, it's not radical, but radical life extension would be the notion, if you can do that, then hypothetically, people could live until 1,000 years old. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean, and you're clear about this in the book, that you would live forever, because you could still be taken out or die, so to speak, if there was an accident, if there was an infection, if you were killed by, you were murdered. So there it's not necessarily living forever, and there is a distinction there, but it's this notion that maybe we could live till kind of indefinitely in this young state, unless something like that struck. Is that the way you look at it?
That's the way I look at it. I will add one thing. The 1,000-year figure is just an actuarial statistic. So if you take the current rate of accidents that are not, and causes of death in general that are not related to aging, that aren't age correlated, right? And you take out all the causes of death that are age correlated, and you ask how long would somebody live, according to current actuarial statistics, it'd be on average 1,000 years. But that's an average. You know, one person might take the pill and get hit by a bus tomorrow and they're out of the picture. Another one might take it and live 10,000 years. We don't know. It depends on how badly they want to, how lucky they are, how cautious they are, and so forth. But it's not as though you hit 900 and think, oh my God, I've got 100 years left. I better use my time well or something like that. It's every day you wake up and you've got potentially another 1,000 years from that day on.
And that risk every morning you wake up presumably the exact same as the day before when you woke up, that, okay, now I've got the same risk as I always did of getting hit by a bus. But like you said, 900 versus 100 doesn't mean you're any more likely to die that next day.
That's right. That's right. It's related to something called the gambler's fallacy. You know, apparently if you toss a quarter 100 times and it ends up head each time, it's not more likely to be tails on the next toss. It's just very unlikely to be 100 times head in, you know, in the first place.
So let's get into the fun stuff then. Let's pretend we're there.
Okay.
I know the answer because I read your book, but do you take that pill or not?
I would take it. I don't know for sure that I would never stop taking it. I don't know what extended life is going to be like when it goes on long enough, but sure, I'd take it. My life's going pretty well. I don't expect to have that option, but if somebody gave it to me, I'd take it.
Yeah. And I've had some time to digest this and spur, and I've been debating myself, would I want to if that pill were available? And I think to me, what struck me the most was that the human condition would really change. So let's say, you know, I'm going to live for 1,000 years, right? The whole life trajectory changes. We change. We have multiple career and retirements throughout our lives. We could spend decades living in different parts of the world. Relationships really is what strikes me the most. I mean, the idea that a monogamous relationship would last for 1,000 years is, I mean, I just got married and I love my wife, but I mean, I've even said it's tough to imagine you're going to be compatible with somebody for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
My best friends right now are going to be my best friends in 1,000 years. I hope they would, because I'm attached to that right now, but everything in life is changing. If you live for 1,000 years, you're living many, many, many lives. Everything we know about society and our course of life and our trajectory is different. How do you cope with that or address that when you're thinking about life? Because if we want to extend our life, it's not necessarily extending life the way that we know it.
Mm-hmm. The biological life, but yeah, the circumstances would change. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think a lot of the things you say might happen, probably would happen. It is hard to imagine friendships lasting 1,000 years. Well, I'll say a couple of things about that. And one comment I make, and I make this over and over again against various objections to extended life, is ask yourself one question. If extended life had those drawbacks, would it be a life worse than death? Now, that's a highly personal question. The answer isn't necessarily going to be the same for everybody. But if you feel the answer is yes, that's worse than death, then you shouldn't take the pill. Or you should stop taking it if you've had enough. But I wouldn't expect the answer will be the same for everybody. And in any event, if extended life does turn out to be unattractive, you do have the option of bringing it to an end. You can simply resume aging. The other thing I would say is that when we think about what it would be like to adapt to these changes, think of it this way. There have been several major changes in the human condition already. The development of agriculture, cities, literacy, technology and science, right? Industry. We now live in vast cities that are basically gigantic networks of machines. Our ancestors 10,000 years ago were foraging for berries and grubs and living in little bands of hunter-gatherers. So we've been quite adaptable, and we've managed to put up with a lot of things that we weren't originally designed to do. In my own lifetime, I've seen gay marriage become accepted. It wasn't even talked about when I was a kid. So I think we shouldn't underestimate our capacity to be flexible and learn new ways of living, and we certainly would have enough time to do that.
That's a very strong argument about adaptability. When we agriculture is a great example there. When agriculture was adopted and became a new part of society, was it so gradual that maybe if I was 20, I would never really feel the full effects of that change? Whereas with this, if life extension becomes available to a 20-year-old, let's say in 20 years it becomes available, it's kind of this radical shift where you do need to maybe say, I looked for my first 20 years of life that this was going to be my trajectory, but now I need to decide, am I going to make this radical change? And
yeah. Yeah, it certainly changes the narrative shape of a life, no question about that. I mean, we have a tendency, especially educated middle-class people, have a tendency to think of life as like a career or a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it has an arc to it, and there's a theme to it, and so forth, like a good book would have, right? I don't think that's necessarily the only way to live. It may not even be the best one. It may be that we spend too much time worrying about our resumes and our careers, and maybe we just need to be a little bit more Buddhist in our approach and just kind of go with the flow, not get too attached to how things are, and just experience each new day as it comes along. So yeah, I think it probably would change the overall structure of our life trajectory, but perhaps in ways that are good. We might get less attached to certain things that we shouldn't be attached to. We might have more equanimity in the face of death if we lived long enough to do everything we wanted to do while we were alive, even if we're still in good health. So I don't think we should worry too much about whether or not the changes we'll have to adapt to are going to be difficult. I'm optimistic that we can do them.
I like the way you phrased that there about reevaluating, even in our current life scheme, the way we look at life stages. This whole podcast initially originated out of the idea that there is this kind of preconceived path, this preordained path that we all do follow, where you get married. And I've said this so many times on the podcast for those who've listened, where you have a certain education, you have a monogamous relationship, you get married, you have a career, you build your resume, like you said, and then you retire. And there's that works for certain people, but for many people, we just tend to fall into it because that's the status quo. And this topic really makes you question that whole paradigm itself when you think about, well, what if I did have 1,000 years that I could imagine? Well, and then it makes you question, well, wait, let's say I have 100 years now. Is this the way I actually want to live those 100 years?
Yeah.
It makes you question the way you live now even.
Oh yeah. No, I think if somebody came along and said, here's an extra 200 years, Sir David, do what you like with it, I probably wouldn't continue doing philosophy, or I might do it long enough to write the next two or three books I have in mind and then stop. And maybe I'd go become an architect, or maybe I'd just become a bum and wander around the world with a backpack and see the sight, or I might get religious. I don't know, but I would use it as an opportunity to try something new now that I've got enough time to do it.
The adapting thing, I think you make, it's a very excellent point you make that we've adapted so much. I think for me, it would be so challenging. And it's just because I think it speaks to human nature. I know I'm a nostalgic person. I know that. So the idea of me not having my best friends and my current partner for my whole life, you asked, is it better than death to lose that? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It almost sounds silly to say death is better, but there's there's such an attachment that we have to the relationships we have and to what we know that it can be really tough to even, I'm sure there are some people who are listening who are saying that's nuts. Of course, that's better than death if your relationships resolve. And there's probably other people who are feeling, well, no, I'd rather have an 100-year life where I know that the bubble I've created is safe. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it challenging to discuss because everybody, it depends on how much you value nostalgia, how much you value your current relationships, or how much you're okay with valuing a relationship and then realizing time might take us apart and over 1,000 years, that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some questions we cannot answer from an armchair. So thinking about what extended life will be like and how we'll handle it, I can speculate as well as the next person. But I think the question to ask yourself is, would you want to make that decision once and for all now? Or would you want to try extended life for a few decades and see how it goes? And then if you feel it's not really such a good idea, you simply stop taking your life extension meds, so to speak, go off your meds. And I would assume the body will just resume aging and die. There's reasons to believe that life extension will probably involve some combination of one or more of the following: some kind of a drug, possibly stem cells, possibly genetic engineering. And all of those either have to be sustained over time, or they are, in the case of genetic engineering, probably reversible. So I think it's colored a little bit by some of the fables we've all grown up with where, you know, somebody, you know, a mischievous God gives someone eternal life, and it turns out it's not so great and they can't do anything about it now. But it's not going to be like that. That's a way of meditating upon whether you'd want to live forever if you had to make the decision once and for all. But that's not what we're going to have to do. We'll have time to revisit the decision.
I want to go through a couple of the arguments that you address in the book that some skeptics of life extension would propose. So One is this idea of loss of self or meaning of life, that if you're living so long, you're going to evolve so much. You're going to change so much, and you might not even recognize yourself. I probably wouldn't recognize certain elements of myself. I don't even know if my human memory is capable of remembering certain aspects of myself 200 years from now, or the experiences. And the way we tend to look at our lives is in this linear trajectory where everything does sort of culminate for the better, and it makes us this wiser person, and the negatives ultimately end up in this positive. But if you're living for 1,000 years, some people probably fear that you would lose yourself and you would lose that trajectory of soul searching and meaning. How do you address that fear that some people would have?
Yeah, so let me put those into two different categories. There's this issue of whether yourself would survive all these changes. Then there's an issue about meaning. So I'll put meaning to one side for a second. Well, the first thing I would say is that when I think about my own life, I have changed incredibly since I was a small child. I'm nothing like him. I mean, he was me and he became me, but there's a vast difference between what I'm like now and what I was like at the age of 4. But the changes occurred slowly, right? There was never a moment when suddenly there was a shift of vision or something and bang, I'm an entirely different kind of person. And it would be the same in an extended life. You will change very gradually, you know, day to day, month to month, year to year, decade to decade. You might not notice being different from one day to the next. You just realize, oh yeah, 20 years ago, I was kind of different in certain ways. And 100 years ago, I have nothing in common with him. So then the question is it worth having that kind of a life because yourself eventually fades out? Well, you don't want to ask whether or not the entire future is worth living, because you won't be in that future if yourself were to disappear. What you want to ask is it worth living a while longer for now? Mm-hmm. And when you get to the end of that stage, is it worth living a while longer for that stage, and so forth? And I think if you ask the question that way, the personal identity objection is really not very powerful. Now, on the meaning issue, I guess the first thing I want to say is meaning can be thought of in two ways. You can say that a life can have meaning in an objective sense. You can say it has meaning in a subjective sense. So if it has meaning in an objective sense, that means that your life is objectively valuable. It's an objectively good thing that you're here and that you're living. Okay. Now, I don't think there's anything about extending your life that would make it less objectively valuable. You know, whatever value we have as thinking beings, we're still going to have if we're around for a long time. It's not like a shorter life increases our value in that way. So I don't think objective meaning is an issue. And insofar as meaning comes from doing good works and helping others, you can do that for 1,000 years if you want to. Subjective meaning is another matter. So subjective meaning has to do with whether you see your life as being good for you. Do you think that life and continuing to be alive is a good thing for you, or that it's a good thing that you're still alive? And that, I think, is really just the boredom issue in another guise. You know, what we're really talking about is whether or not we think our lives would become boring to us.
Do you think they would become boring to us?
I honestly don't know. You know, this is one of those questions where I want to say, you can't answer this from an armchair. I think we just have to try it out and see. But I think there's some reason to believe it wouldn't. You know, you can try a lot of different things. Let's say I lived for 1,000 years, okay, and I'm doing philosophy right now, and then I become an architect. I always wanted to be an architect. And then maybe I stop working for a while and I meditate or something. And then I become a musician, perhaps, or an actor, or maybe I become a, you know, an engineer or a software programmer. Anyway, let's say 1,000 years from now, I'm painting. So let's say I haven't done philosophy for 500 years. Well, when I come back to it, it's probably going to be fresh and new. I mean, I can't remember stuff from last year sometimes. I'm not going to remember for 5 centuries. So there may be some repetition, but there's no harm in that. It's going to be just as much fun for me the second time around if I wait long enough.
It's kind of exciting hearing you talk about it. Like you said, who knows if you'd get bored? And you can always stop taking the pill if you do get bored, as you can do if there's anything about life extension that doesn't appeal to you. But for some people listening, including myself, it's probably pretty cool, this notion that you could have so many different careers and lives. And when you're saying that, my first gut is, oh, that's like, nobody does that many things, but also nobody lives that long. If you were to live that long, it would be completely feasible and probable that you'd have so many different interests and hobbies you take up. I mean, you could be an absolute rock star guitarist at one part of your life. And then 200 years later, you're living something completely, completely different, because it's a long time.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
There's a quote, believe it or not, from Batman, from The Dark Knight, where it says, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And that's always resonated with me. And it's not that I think everybody would become a villain, but if you live long enough, I think everybody's probably going to do some things they're less proud of. And that part of yourself might be tough to grapple with.
Yeah.
With so much time to live, it's almost unfathomable to me that not everybody would make some serious mistakes. I mean, we think about prison like it's this horrible thing. Way more people would probably serve prison stints. Way more people would have many, many crises in their lives where they do bad things. And as exciting as life extension could be, some people might be turned off of it by saying, I don't know what I would do in 1,000 years, who I would turn into.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I never actually thought about that one. I mean, to kind of continue your theme for a minute, If you imagine that everybody is capable under the right circumstances of flying into a rage and murdering somebody, and it probably is possible under the right, however improbable circumstances, well, within 85 or 100 years, I can avoid doing that. I can police myself well enough not to do that. But given 1,000 years to screw up, I might screw up somewhere along the way. And yeah, I guess there is that hazard. To be honest with you, Zale, I'm not quite sure what I want to say to that.
It's not necessarily a bad, I mean, I'm saying if I murdered somebody, it's a bad thing, but a lot of it's just ego, right? A lot of it might just be an acceptance of dissolving your ego and acknowledging, listen, so much is going to happen in 1,000 years, whatever I think of myself is going to really evolve very much. But I think the most manageable way to do that, as you explained earlier and as you outlined in the book, is maybe to try not look at it that way of what's going to happen in 200 years. Maybe look at it as what's going to happen in the next 10 years and live your life that way.
Yeah, live your life as a series of stepping stones, day by day or year by year or whatever. Yeah. One of the thoughts I had while we were talking about this, as I think about it, probably most of the things I'm not proud of happened when I was young. I'm just a better behaved person now, partly from experience and introspection and learning from my mistakes. And I don't know, maybe we'll get even better still if we have more time. Who knows?
I want to transition now to the second part of your book. Let's say it's here and people decided life extension is going to be adopted. You establish some definitions. There are going to be haves, there's going to be will nots, and there's going to be have nots. Explain that to the listeners in terms of what that means in terms of the adoption of life extension.
Yes. So at first, I anticipate life extension will not be available to everybody because not everybody can afford it. So initially, there'll be those who have it and they use it and they want it. Then there'll be others who can get it. They've got enough money, but for whatever reason, they turn it down. Those are the will nots. And the have-nots are simply whoever wants it and can't get it, or doesn't want it, can't get it for that matter. Now, eventually, the have-not, I hope, will just fade out and everybody will be either a have or a will not. But I thought about it in terms of these three groups because each of them is affected differently by some of the social issues, including an issue that you raised just now.
And what's the Malthusian issue?
Malthusian issue is the possibility that life extension will ultimately lead to a burgeoning population at a level the planet just can't sustain. that will simply overpopulate the earth. And I have to say, this is the one objection to life extension that really worries me. All the others, I think we can handle one way or another. This one is much harder to solve because it's going to require self-restraint on our part. But it happens for a couple of reasons. One reason is when people live longer, they may just have more children. Right? That's the most obvious way in which life extension might lead to overpopulation. But interestingly enough, even if they don't have more children, even if they still have 2 children per couple, let's say, the population will still increase if we live long enough with radical life extension, will still increase way beyond what it would in a normal lifespan.
Each generation is going to then have a couple kids themselves and a couple kids themselves.
And it leads to something I'll call the lingering guest problem. So imagine you're at a dinner party, your living room can handle 20 people, not dinner party, let's just say it's a party that runs for 10 hours. You've invited 200 people. They're coming randomly during the day. Your room can accommodate 20 of them at a time. Sometimes you've got 10, sometimes you've got 30. But as long as they come randomly and they leave every hour, everything's fine. But if they hang around and don't leave, the room's going to get incredibly crowded. And the same is true with the planet, right? If the generations hang around decade after decade, century after century, it could be like a crowded room. There's a kind of carryover effect. And so we ran some statistics. The fellow I worked with actually developed the formula. He did all the statistical stuff. But it looks like we could have some pretty significant population increase in a radical life extension scenario where people just don't age or age extremely slowly.
Because we already do have an issue of overpopulation with climate change. There's going to be more refugee crises. So it seems like it would be a very, very significant issue, right? If we were even having a larger population. So how do you propose in your book, in your thesis, that we could overcome that? Because as you said, it is a very significant crisis. If the world becomes extremely overpopulated with poverty, hunger, climate change, those are very real considerations right now. Take out people living for longer.
Yeah, I think there is one other possible way to do it that I'll come to in a moment. But the main way to do it is simply to restrict our reproduction. And there's 2 ways you can do that. I mean, one is just to have fewer babies. The other is to space the births out farther apart. So my demographer colleague, Shaheen Davidpour, found out through his work that if a woman has one baby when she's, say, 20, and another baby when she's 150 or 500 years old or whatever, the effect on population is far less. There's something about spacing the births out that actually makes the impact of this a lot easier to handle. Of course, that requires not having a kid for some decades or centuries or whatever, and that may not be our first choice. But I don't see a way to do it without simply limiting reproduction for those who get life extension. You'd have to make it somehow conditional upon their not having too many children and maybe take it away from them if they do have too many children. And then I have a policy in my book that I call forced choice, where people are forced to make that choice. You can have extended life and fewer kids, or you can have a regular life and as many kids as you want, but you got to choose one or the other.
And when do you make that choice?
Well, you can make it at any time, but here's the catch. If you have a kid, you have in effect made the choice, right? How shall I put this? If we were to limit reproduction to one child for every other woman, that's 0.5 children per, that's a pretty extreme limit. Let's just take that for discussion. So you go into the lottery and your chance of having a child is going to be 25% because you're going to have it with somebody else and their chance is 25%, right? So you get one child per every other woman. So if somebody wants life extension and they get it and they want to have a child, in the lottery, they'd have a 25% chance of being allowed to have a child. That's for the 0.5 children scenario. If somebody's already had a child, then the only way they could get life extension is to enter a different lottery where they have a 25% chance of getting extended life.
Gotcha. So let's say I'm a woman, I'm not, but if I were a woman and I already had a child and I hadn't really, for whatever reason, I had a child, and then I decided, you know what, I'd really like life extension. I initially actually wouldn't be eligible for life extension because I've already exceeded the amount of kids I could have. Because if I had wanted life extension initially, I would have had to go into a lottery in the first place to determine, was I one of the lucky ones to be able to have kids? But you're saying if I changed my mind, there's another lottery I could go in which they would say, okay, this is a lottery for people who already had kids and maybe changed their mind for wanting life extension.
Yeah. You still go through a lottery. It's just that what you're going to get is whatever you don't have. If you don't have a kid, you got a 25% chance of that. If you don't have extended life, but you've got the kid, you've got a 25% chance of getting extended life. Or the chances could be higher, obviously, if we're going to have, you know, more generous limits on how many kids people can have.
But, so it's really this choice that people would be forced to make on some level understanding there is luck via the lottery to alter your fortunes, that do you want to have a kid? Or do you want to be 100% certain you get to have a kid? Or do you want to be 100% certain you have life extension?
Well, if I had to choose between the two, I would say the latter.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want kids so badly that I would give up centuries of life to have one.
Some people listening might think this is extreme and sounding like it's kind of, it would turn into an authoritarian type of system where you're in this lottery, this dystopian kind of world where in order to have kids, you need government authority to do that. Do you have any concerns that it would turn into that kind of authoritarian type of system?
Well, if you're living in a democracy, the limits would have to be the result of a democratic process, of course. So whether it's authoritarian or not in its inception will depend on how the decision was reached socially. But as far as the policy itself goes, it's not like China's one-child policy. There's a couple of differences. One difference is being under this limit is voluntary. You're under this limit only if you want extended life. Your life won't get any shorter. You'll still have a normal lifespan, much like the lives we have now. But if you want something extra, then you've got to limit yourself in this one way. So there's a choice involved. The other reason I don't think it's unjust or ethically worrisome is that liberty is standardly said to be limited by something we call the harm principle. So you have a right of liberty to do what you like with your own life, provided you don't harm other people in the process. So if life extension could lead to a Malthusian disaster, well, that's a harm. So your liberty to extend your life would legitimately be limited by the need to protect the entire world from that kind of harm from everyone who's extending their life. Yeah, I think where it might look authoritarian on the surface would be when somebody's, you know, broken the rules. They had too many kids after a life extension or whatever. What do we do with that? So the enforcement might be a bit of an issue, but that may just be what it takes to make this work. Because if you look at the numbers, radical life extension, not talking about moderate, but radical life extension, it's really striking how much larger the world's population can get, even with very modest fertility levels, like 2 kids per children per woman. If you go up to 3 children per woman, it gets catastrophic. So we have to do something.
Was 0.5 kids per woman, is that what your demographer determined was the reasonable number of kids that could be had to not end up in a Malthusian crisis?
It depends on how you define Malthusian crisis. So I started out very conservatively and I said, suppose you want the world's population to be no more than 1/3 larger as a result of life extension. Mm-hmm. I think it larger for other reasons, right? But you want to aim for a scenario where life extension increases the total world population by about 33%. Let's say that's the target. If that's the target and you've got a 1,000-year lifespan, unless you space the births out quite a bit, you've really got to limit it to 1 child per every other woman. So that's how we got to that figure. Now, if you space the births further apart, you can be a little bit more generous. Or if you tolerate a larger increase for a while, you can be more generous. Because one of the interesting things about these population projections is that the population increases quite a bit, but in a lot of these scenarios, it eventually comes down again. So presumably when it's coming down, you could loosen some of these controls a bit, though it may take, you know, decades or centuries for that to happen.
And why does it come down?
Honestly, I don't know.
But that's just what we found.
We ran the projections. Yeah, I don't know the underlying explanation. I do want to comment briefly on something I often hear. You haven't brought it up yet, but it comes up all the time. In fact, Jeff Bezos said something like this the other day. The colonies in space solution. You know, the idea that technology is going to save us and we'll live in colonies in outer space or we'll raise more food for the Earth or whatever. And my response to that is that would be wonderful. And I'm certainly not against trying, but I think it's a bit unwise to put all our eggs in that one basket. At one point, I just ran some back of the envelope calculations and I said, what if we put everybody in the world today on cruise ships? Let's say that life extension were to double the population of the Earth. We decide that's too many, so we want to take half that total, 8 billion people, our current population, and put them all on cruise ships on the ocean. We don't have colonies in space, but we have cruise ships, and we know what they cost. And it turns out it would take like a generation or so for the world's economy to pay for all those cruise ships, and that doesn't even count the sources of food and power and the fact that you're sharing a cabin with somebody for the rest of your life. So I think colonies in space is great, but I think it's going to be a lot harder to do than people concede when they make that argument.
Totally. We've had an astrophysicist on this from Harvard on the podcast before, and we got a little into that topic. And he said, that's the stuff. Presently, that's the stuff of fantasies. The idea that, and you're right, maybe whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, I don't know. And that's beyond the scope of this. But he said we're very, 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 very far away. And that's pure fantasy.
I think he's right.
One debate challenge that comes up in your book in terms of the global implications of life extension is this notion of a socioeconomic gap, a power divide. And like you said, there's a couple groups. There's the people who elect to have life extension, but then there's all those people who can't afford life extension.
Yes.
And there's the people who can't, who just decide they don't want life extension. For the sake of ease for this, we'll just lump all those people as the ones who don't have life extension and the ones who do have life extension. If we have a world where half the population, for example, says, I want to live forever and, or not age, and we have half the population who says, no, I'd like to kind of just take my normal lifespan. Do you anticipate some sort of power divide or some sort of kind of supernatural feeling and entitlement that maybe the people who are going to live indefinitely feel over the people who are here for just maybe a tenth of their lifespan?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. Brief prefatory comment. I think in time, the choice not to use life extension may become as eccentric as the choice not to have sex and lead a life of celibacy. So it may be that we never get to that situation, but let's just suppose we do.
So you're saying there, though, that so you think in time most people would opt
would want it, and also that they'll be able to get it. I think the cost of the technology will come down, and the level of prosperity will continue to rise as it has, and eventually they'll intersect, and everybody will be able to get one. Sure. But there is this period of time, of course, when you've got these two very different groups of people. The difference in power is worrisome. In my book, I talk a little bit about a couple of things I call entrenched elders and opportunity drought. And I'll use the academic world as an example. I'm a tenured full professor. I can retire when I want to. Well, I could just hang around for centuries and younger faculty could never get the job, right? That's an entrenched elder. And because there's no jobs, you've got an opportunity drought. And that's just one of the ways in which those who lead extended lives might have more power than those who don't. I can also imagine
you have tenure, for example, and then there's a bunch of professors. It's really tough for a younger person to get into the market where all the jobs are taken up.
Yeah, and that'll be true across the board in lots of professions, although they don't all have tenure. Tenure makes it a bit worse. But people can be entrenched through seniority in other ways.
So it's interesting to think that there would be kind of two separate pools. I mean, aside from those practical issues of maybe seniority, I wonder what the interaction would be between people who are living forever and people who are opting for a normal lifespan. I wonder if there would be dating between the two different pools, you know? I mean, knowing that you could fall in love with somebody and that their lifespan and their life trajectory is going to look really, really different from yours. I wonder the psychology of that.
Well, I think there's two scenarios to consider. One is a scenario where the person who doesn't have life extension could get it if they wanted to. Or will not. The other is the scenario where the person can't get life extension, whether they want it or not. They're a have-not. So let's take the have-nots, because I think the problem you raise is more severe over there. I think there'll be not only difficulties forming friendships and relationships, so that's definitely going to happen, because people whose life trajectory is so radically different will just look at the future differently and make different kinds of commitments. But I also think there's going to be a massive wave of resentment, rage, frustration, distress is what I refer to these things as collectively. And I take that very seriously as a harm to the have-nots. I mean, one of the things we have to realize with life extension, and I'm a supporter of it, I'm all in favor, you know, full speed ahead. But I think we have to be honest with ourselves. It is going to cause some harm along the way. Malthusian problems are one of those harms. But another is just that the have-nots get harmed in certain ways by being have-nots. And so our relations with them could get quite tense.
Yeah, and I'd argue even the will-nots, those who could have it but decide not to, relationships maybe not as tense, but in some situations could be tense because you're just living different lives, right? There's no way about it. If I know I'm going to die at 100 and I'm interacting with a bunch of people who are banking a living to 1,000, there's no way that can't influence some sort of discrepancy in a relationship and cause some sort of divide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the cons, right? The life extension is a set of pros and cons. This is one of the factors that weighs in the scale of the disadvantages of life extension.
And I'll bring it back to end things here with how you started. You said, ultimately, the big question we need to ask is, for all these cons, what's better, life extension or death?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is extended life a life worse than death? That's the question each person has to answer for themselves.
And I think you're right. Each person needs to answer that for themselves, because again, as I was contemplating over this, because I really have not been able to stop thinking about this topic since I read your book, one of the things that came to my mind is, I don't know, maybe we don't know what happens after death, right? And I have no idea. Nobody knows what happens after death, though there are some people who say they see a white light, and there are a lot of people who believe that after death is actually better than life. Yeah. So some people might say, well, actually, for me, the answer is easier. Death, life is filled with a lot of suffering. Life can be really, really hard. And maybe the joke's on us if we're trying to live forever and we find out that death is actually some form of heaven or whatever you want to call it, where there's a lot more peacefulness to it.
You know, if I ever get a chance to do a revised version of this book, I want to add a section on that issue, because somebody brought that up with me after the book was published. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good question. The possibility of an afterlife is something I actually take very, very seriously. You know, I think it's difficult to account for the similarities in near-death experiences across cultures and types of people and centuries and time. And one way to account for it is to say they're all similar because there's something real these people are all perceiving. When different people see something the same way, it's likely they're seeing the same thing. These aren't like drug hallucinations where what I get on acid is different from what you get on acid. So I take this very seriously. And one of the questions people have to ask themselves is, do you want to delay your entry to the afterlife if you think there is one and you think it's going to be a good one? And I'm not sure if there's a wrong answer to that. You know, I think some people may say, I've gotten as much as I can out of this life. I've become convinced there's another better one. And no, I don't want to hang around any longer. I've done enough here. But other people may, like me, make a very different choice and say, it's always there, right? It's not going to go away. The train's not going to leave the station before I get on board. Sooner or later, I am going to die, either because I voluntarily go off the meds or because something killed me, an accident or violence or disease or whatever. It's just going to take a while longer.
Well, John, it's an incredibly intriguing topic. It's mind-bending, and I imagine everybody listening to this will be thinking afterwards, would I take this pill? Would I be bored? Would I love all these new experiences I could have? Would I be too scared to change the way I know the world is, which is fair? Would I be afraid the way it would alter my relationships? But it's completely thought-provoking, and you did an incredible job in your book in outlining the ethical issues and in outlining a potential way it could work if one day this comes. Thank you so much for joining me. Where can people learn about you, and how can I direct people to New Methuselah's, your book?
Well, it's issued by MIT Press, so there's two places you could get it. You can go to the MIT Press website and obtain it there. You can also go to Amazon.
John Davis, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Sal. I appreciate it, and it's been fun.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. You can dream tonight about whether you would take that pill or not, and have a great day.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.